Welcome back to 1A. It's Todd Zwillick. If you think you haven't been face-to-face with artificial intelligence, let me ask you a few questions. Do you own an iPhone? Have you ever used Google to look up your ex? Have you ever boarded a plane while on standby? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then you have, without question, had an AI encounter. Now, AI gets to know us very well, very quickly. But how much should we know about the people who make AI? Our guest today says it's a very small club, like-minded people who create and control machines that make decisions for all of us every day. Amy Webb is a professor of strategic foresight at NYU. She's also founder of the Future Today Institute, and her new book pulls back the curtain on artificial intelligence and how seamlessly the technology is finding new ways to integrate itself into our everyday lives. The book is called The Big Nine: How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. And she joins me now from NPR in New York. Professor Webb, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Well, we'd love to hear from you as well. What questions do you have about AI and the role it plays in your life? You can comment on that AI called Facebook. You can tweet us on that platform, that AI platform called Twitter at 1A, or email us 1A@WAMU.org. Professor Webb, I'm so glad you're here. Just to start us off, if you don't mind, I'd like you to listen to a very mundane sounding phone call that took place just last year.
Good evening.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. I'd like to reserve a table for Friday the 3rd.
Okay, hold on one moment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So Friday, November 3rd. How many people?
For two people.
Now, that sounds like the everyday task of somebody making a dinner reservation, but the call is not a diner. It's Duplex. Duplex is a Google artificial intelligence program that can make calls on your behalf. That clip came from CNET. But Professor Webb, when I hear this call, I hear an AI that sounds so human that it's going to want to host radio shows pretty soon and put me out of work. But as somebody who thinks about AI and how it works and where it's going, I'm curious what you hear when you listen to that call.
Sure. I think what I hear is one example among many, many examples in which AI has been trained to replicate us for a variety of different purposes. So that's a great example of an AI doing something for us that would be mundane. And I think the intention was good, right? It's really annoying to make reservations for dinner, for haircuts. So let's make an AI do it. I think the challenge is when there's no transparency and the human on the other end doesn't know that they're interacting with a machine. So we've actually seen many different examples of this. There more recently was a brand new website called This Person Does Not Exist, which is safe for work. If you click and refresh that, you'll see automatically generated humans, faces, for the most part look convincingly real. And none of the people that you will see as you refresh that page over and over again are real people. There's examples of this in video. There's examples of this in text generation. And that's something that should give us all quite a bit of pause as we think about what all of this means for our futures.
Now, we tend to fall back on Siri and Alexa when we have these discussions about AI because they're in our homes and we talk to them with, female pronouns as though they're people. But what other forms of AI are already operating in our lives that we might not be aware of? I mentioned boarding a plane on standby. That's one example you give in your book. What else?
Sure. You know what? When most people think about artificial intelligence, they immediately think of Skynet or Westworld, or any of the other anthropomorphized human-like robot things that we've seen in pop culture. But in actuality, AI surrounds us. So, jobs, people applying for jobs in a lot of large companies. The first person looking at your resume is not—it's not a person at all. It's an AI system that is going through and mining your data and looking for certain matches. And that really goes against the grain of what all of us were taught when we were in school about how to create a resume specifically for the right hiring manager, right? AI systems are now looking for specific things on our resumes that are not entirely clear to us, and a lot of people are being discriminated against without their knowledge.
We're going to talk in detail about the discrimination that can result when the people who write AI aren't diverse themselves. And we've seen example after example of that in the news, and I'm sure many other cases that never got out when experiments or AIs, at least in the eyes of most of us, went wrong. Professor Webb, your book is called The Big Nine. I suspected at first it was about the Supreme Court, but of course it's not. It's about the nine giant companies that sort of control the AI future right now. Who are they, and what does that control look like in your estimation?
Sure. So there are nine companies that primarily control the overwhelming amount of money that's being poured into the system. They have the lion's share of patents. They're able to attract the very best talent from around the world. They have the biggest and most important partnerships with universities. They're building the custom frameworks, the custom silicon, all of the algorithms, you know, all of the systems that make up AI. And those companies are split between the United States and China. So there are three in China, collectively known as the BAT: Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. In the United States, there are six, which I like to call the G Mafia. So that is Google, Amazon, Microsoft, IBM, Facebook, and Apple. And this doesn't mean that there aren't other companies working in the ecosystem, but overwhelmingly, it's these companies that have concentrated power. And I guess my concern is, if the fastest growing power to change our futures, which is AI, was concentrated in just the hands of nine decision makers, is that the kind of thing that we should be worried about? And while I don't think the big nine players here are necessarily the villains, I do think that we need to take a hard look at that concentration of power and whether or not we're all comfortable with the decisions that are being made.
Now, you talked about the power of the big nine. You talked about Skynet and Westworld and some of the dystopian visions of our minds when we think about AI. We tend to have this fallback. Either it's going to create this great utopian reality or a dystopian catastrophe like Skynet in Terminator. Mark Zuckerberg, who, of course, is the founder and CEO of Facebook, one of the first names in the big nine, seems to fall on one very particular end of this spectrum. Listen.
With AI especially, I'm really optimistic. And I think that people who are naysayers and kind of try to drum up these doomsday scenarios are, I don't understand it. I think it's really negative. And in some ways, I actually think it's pretty irresponsible.
Mark Zuckerberg feels like the naysayers are negative and irresponsible, and he just doesn't get it, Professor Webb.
Well, I'm a pragmatist, and my job, what I do for a living, is I look at data, I build models, I look for patterns and trends, and then I figure out what plausible futures are ahead. And I intentionally look across a spectrum. So I force, you know, our model forces an optimistic framing, a pragmatic framing, and a catastrophic one. So I just say that because there's a lot of misplaced optimism and fear when it comes to AI, and that's because we haven't, as individuals, taken enough time to understand what it really is. So we have these fallbacks, is exactly as you said. Or we go in the other direction and think that somehow AI is going to usher in this utopia. Well, the real world is different, and we have to get away from these layers of abstraction and think about the real implications ahead. And the biggest concern that I have is that, you know, look throughout history at all of the different technology that and science that humanity has invented. This stuff always goes in directions that nobody thought of in advance. It happens every single time. So the pragmatist in me thinks that humanity is better off if we just, you know, push up our sleeves and confront deep uncertainty. And take a good hard look at what we're doing.
We've been hearing from so many of you on the issue of our AI future. Robert writes to us on Facebook and says, AI will still have the human values that are programmed into it. It's no more hidden than the human value-driven decisions that are made today. It's just that this way you can blame a soulless machine. We're going to talk about that issue too, but Roger commented on our webpage, these nine companies are the biggest threat to freedom and democracy that America faces today. In comparison to Russia, it's no threat at all. If you control what information gets out to the American public, you are in the position of political control. You can manipulate the public in any way your elite interests desire. When you talk about the American side of the AI Big Nine, Professor Webb, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, IBM, and others, we have to mention one thing at the base of all of this, which is profit, which is the ultimate goal. Developing this AI in all these fascinating, sundry, and sometimes disconcerting ways, but all for one singular goal.
Yeah, so, you know, these are publicly traded companies, and they have a responsibility to their shareholders and investors to turn a profit. The challenge is when there is a rush because investors are putting incredible, extraordinary pressure on these companies, that there is a rush to continually productize and commercialize this fundamental basic research. You know, the thing that somehow everybody has forgotten is that game-changing, groundbreaking R&D is not really funded by our federal government anymore, or at least not anywhere close to the way that it used to be. And we have, you know, we've delegated this to the private sector. So the challenge is that you can't schedule R&D the same way that you schedule your quarterly meetings. And these incredibly bright, hardworking engineers are under the gun now to constantly produce shiny new things, because that's on the schedule. You can't schedule R&D breakthroughs. So there's, at the moment, what I'm observing is speed prioritized over safety. And there's not enough, first of all, there's no financial incentive to come up with guardrails or to sandbox, you know, parts of this technology or to do risk modeling in advance. There's no economic incentive to doing that. So therefore, it's not being done. And it would be terrific if we, you know, again, I think the G Mafia, I think the Big Nine are the heroes of this story. I really do. If we can change our developmental track. But we have to cut these guys some slack and give them the ability to do research and to incentivize them to do research in the public interest. You know, so but we have to, again, we've got to get away from these companies are evil. And investors constantly demanding shiny new products, and the media, not assuming that there's some catastrophic issue within a company if they're not producing something brand new every couple months. And going back to that Duplex example from the beginning.
Well, let's take just a quick moment. Sure. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A. Amy Webb, go right ahead.
So that Duplex example from the beginning, you know, that was a product that really wasn't, first of all, I don't think it exists in a concrete form, and it probably wasn't ready to be rolled out. And they didn't think through what the backlash might look like. And yet, if Google didn't have something shiny and new to debut, you know, that was in the realm of AI, they were going to face criticism in the media. So we've got to change our thinking. The challenge is that artificial intelligence, as it progresses, in service to our market economy, is probably going to wind up being incongruous with what's best for humanity.
Well, there are different imperatives in China, and you write about this in detail, because unlike the U.S. government, the Chinese government is heavily involved in the future of AI. Here's Qi Lu, the COO of Baidu, talking about China's investment in AI research.
In general, the Chinese government at this stage has a lot more willingness to invest in infrastructures, in talent. And they, in particular, see AI as an opportunity for China to, in many ways, to ride that big wave.
Amy Webb, China's imperatives in the development of AI are, as I said, very different from those of American companies. How are they different? What is China doing with its massive investments in AI?
So there are three companies, again, the BAT, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent, which technically are independent companies, but because it's China, they are very much under the thumb of Beijing. You know, China has this, first of all, China is very good at long-term planning, and they may not always make good on those long-term strategies, but it's part of their governing culture. They have President Xi Jinping, who, because of some rule changes, is now effectively president for life, and he is a brilliant person who really both understands technology and how to deploy that technology in service of Chinese interests all around the world. So that's why it's important to look at not just China investing huge amounts of its sovereign wealth fund toward building and developing out AI, or looking at, for example, how the Chinese government has issued a new textbook that is going out to kindergartners as of this year, because every kindergartner in China is going to start learning about machine learning when they're very, very little, or about all the repatriation plans and proposals to bring back academics and researchers to China to do work within the country. You also have to look at things like the BRI, the Brick and Road Initiative, which on the face of it looks like a clever way for China along its old Silk Road trading route and in new places to build better economic ties through things like building bridges, literal bridges, and other kinds of infrastructure. But part of the BRI is also digital. And so China, in 58 pilot countries around the world right now, is laying 5G and fiber, and they're deploying their AI in ways that should be fairly disturbing. You want to talk about the social credit score?
Because we got this very question from a listener. Are any of the nine companies involved, or have they used technology modified for the Chinese government's citizen score and facial recognition system? And I take it the answer is yes.
Yeah. So the BAT are very much involved in the social credit score. And for those listeners who aren't familiar with it, essentially, this is a system of reporting on many different facets of everyday Chinese life through persistent recognition and surveillance to build a score for all Chinese citizens that measures their capability of being a sort of model citizen. And they are awarded and demoted points based on things they do, like jaywalk or meritorious work that they might do in their community, or tell lies, or have a driving infraction. The list goes on and on and on. So this is a part of Chinese culture, and it is being automated through artificial intelligence. But that very same system is now being deployed throughout other countries that are part of this new BRI, which means that, and to some extent, this kind of surveillance makes sense in China. It's an automated way of doing some things they've always done, but it's alien in other places around the world.
And it's a new technology being developed under the tutelage of the government that goes to the Chinese government's maybe bottom line imperative, social control and control over the political future of the people in that country. My guest is Amy Webb, professor of strategic foresight at NYU. The future of artificial intelligence, though, lies in the hands of a very small group of like-minded men. So what happens when this group controls the technology that we've come to rely on in ways largely invisible to us? That's coming up next with Amy Webb. Stay close. Welcome back to 1A. It's Todd Zwillick. Before we get back to our conversation with Amy Webb, we'd love your help with tomorrow's program. It's all about the human skeleton. Our bones are the structural building blocks of our bodies, of course. They connect us to our evolutionary ancestors as well. When skin and muscle decompose, it's the bones that are left over, often the only human material to survive over time. So we'll talk about the science and cultural significance of human skeletons. Have you worked with, studied, found, or even purchased human bones? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Tell us your stories about dem bones, whether you've broken one or bought one or just like to shake them once in a while. That number is 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212. We'll share some of your stories about your bones tomorrow on 1A. Amy Webb, diversity in the tech industry is an emerging huge issue, and it's a big part of your book. We've seen controversies at Google and Facebook and other companies. The people working on the technology side, the developers, the machine learning specialists, are overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly male. And when it comes to AI, you make pains to point out in this book that even though the tech industry has attracted those people and they have the best of intentions, it is not the best thing for our futures.
That's right. And, you know, this is the part of the conversation where somebody might be inclined to tune out because they're not part of a minority community. Here's what I would like every single person to understand, and I want to make this crystal clear. We are all being discriminated against in some way. you know, there is a small number of people who happen to be fairly homogenous, but they're also, just by virtue of the fact that that community is small, they can't possibly represent the broader worldviews of us all. So not only is that small group of people and their values being encoded into these systems that are intended to optimize decisions for us all, but those people cannot, I mean, just mathematically, it doesn't work. They can't possibly represent all of us, which means that if you are, if you have conservative viewpoints, you're probably in some ways being discriminated against across different systems. If you're somebody, I mentioned jobs earlier and resumes, if you're somebody who went to like a place like Drexel and university and you took an engineering program that has very little wiggle room for outside courses, but you were really interested in religion or politics, so you took a bunch of extracurriculars, that may actually ding you as an AI is looking through your resume. We're all being discriminated against because currently the developmental track of AI uses values, but there's no general human values atlas. So in some way or another, all of us are on the wrong end of this. And we're just now starting to see the implications of that. As we go forward, you know, the analogy that I like to make is that this is like getting paper cuts. You know, you get one or two paper cuts and it's annoying. You get discriminated against or you see negative content or you see the ill implications of AI that affect you one or two times and maybe it's irritating, right? But if your entire body is covered, like imagine this, your entire body covered in paper cuts, you're alive, but life is nothing like it was before.
Well, the potential for discrimination is broad here. And you mentioned it's not just in the ways we're maybe reflexively used to thinking about it. But let's talk about a couple of specific examples. Amazon, last October, experimented infamously now with a hiring tool that used AI. It ended up being biased against female job candidates. Apple's facial recognition feature on the iPhone experienced some glitches of its own. Listen.
The technology thought, oh, Amazon doesn't like any resume that has the word women's in it. Because the company has hired so many male engineers or software developers, data scientists, and so forth, that clearly the unsuccessful candidates are the ones who also would have this word women's in it.
Is facial recognition technology biased? A researcher at MIT found that the technology works best for white men.
Well, those two clips came to us from Reuters and from Fox 35. These are just two examples. There was a case from 2014 in Florida when two young women got booked by the cops for stealing a bike and a scooter. The summer before, a 40-year-old white repeat offender got booked for shoplifting in the same precinct. The girls who were African-American were rated by an AI system for sentencing as high risk to be re-offenders. The repeat offender, the man, was rated the lowest risk, despite a pretty violent record, including prison time. Amy Webb, how are these AI systems drawing these kinds of conclusions that when we hear about them and read about them after they've happened on the back end, make many, many of us cringe? This is not the world we want to create. This was the world we wanted to get away from.
That's right. And just as a coda to that last story about the girls in Florida, that's exactly right. And the man who was released because the AI determined that he was not a future risk, days after he was released, he recommitted yet another crime.
Right.
So what's going on? I don't think that the people, again, the engineers building these systems, the G Mafia, I don't think that that those people are racist or they are intending to cause harm. The problem is that they lack context. And when you're working with a like-minded group of people who have your worldviews and backgrounds, you tend to forget to include others. And as a result of that, as they're building their machine learning models, they're using their databases, they're building out new systems, you know, they kind of forget about everybody else. And so the problem is that when forgetting everybody else runs into real-world circumstances, now, for crime databases and AI used by law enforcement, that's sort of a big, gnarly, horrible issue, and there's bias and all kinds of problems in that space. But there was a professor named Latanya Sweeney who was worked high up in the federal government, was a Harvard professor, and was searching her name on Google. So she types in Latanya Sweeney, searches for her name, and finds arrest warrants you know, like little advertisements for, are you looking for criminal LaTanya Sweeney? And she's like, what's going on? And did a big survey and a big study. And what happened was that the way the system, the advertising system was trained was to identify black identifying names as more plausible criminals. So again, like, this is a case where people didn't think things through. And the challenge with AI is that we are constantly being classified in some way or another. And so, I mean, I just want to give everybody this little uncomfortable thought to think about. You know, China has a consolidated singular social credit score where it's grouped all of this stuff together. You know, in some ways, we have a similar system already in existence in the United States. It's just not... it's just not a single thing, and it's more of an accident than a planned national strategy. We're all constantly being rated and scored and either given permissions or denied permissions all day long, every day, because of artificial intelligence.
You're making me think, and I hate to even think this, gosh, at least the Chinese are upfront about it. At least they have a name for it, and everyone knows what it is. Here, it's surreptitious. We all submit to it happily. It's convenient. More money out of our pocket. But some of our individuality and some of our control over our own destinies goes with it.
That's right. And there's a fix. The fix to this is being transparent about how those decisions are being made, which of our data are being mined and refined and productized and for what purposes. And to do that up front, rather than waiting for some problem to happen and then make an apology afterwards. The G Mafia's standard operating procedure, I think, is to build stuff first. And oftentimes these companies are so big, the various departments aren't talking to each other. And that's when you get to a situation like Google, apparently having microphones in its Nest thermostats and not telling people that they were capable of recording. I don't think they did it on purpose. I think it's just, you know, they tend to work in these insular environments. They're not transparent about how and why they might be need to collect data in the future. You know, and afterwards they apologize. They're only going to be able to do that so many times before they face regulation. And regulation, I think, is not only not good for the big nine companies, but ultimately for our future, it's not good for us and for democracy either.
It's so difficult to talk about regulation when we're talking about these concepts like human values, like diversity, and like ethics. And people are writing into us about this. Jeff says on our Facebook page, human values change and shouldn't be considered when talking about AI. That's Jeff's point of view. And he gets to a point that I really want to ask you about, Amy Webb. This might be another side of the same problem that you mentioned in terms of diversity in developing AI as we give more and more autonomous decision making to machines. Are we thinking about how to constrain the decisions that machines make with the kind of ethical boundaries that we rely on every single day? I mean, what if an AI is asked to maximize urban living space, which is a thing you might ask an AI to do? It might want to eliminate all humans over 6 feet tall because that'll do the trick. And that means that a guy like me is in trouble. Now, the AI is doing exactly what it asked to do. That's an extreme example, but are the people at the Big Nine thinking about not only ethical constraints, but the kinds of human values that you're talking about, what it means to be a human and what we want our intelligent machines to be thinking about and using to constrain themselves as they make our decisions?
So that's a terrific question, and there's a lot to unpack here. I'm going to try and do it very succinctly.
Sure. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A. Unpack away, Amy Webb. Go right ahead.
Okay. So there are a couple of schools of thought here. One is it's impossible to teach machines all human values. Our values are constantly changing. So let's let systems read all of our popular culture, all of our literature, and let them figure out on their own what makes humanity tick. To me, that is a horrifically bad approach. There's another idea, which is let all of these systems watch and listen to our news. And let
the wrong impression,
determine,
or maybe the right impression, if they do that.
I mean that would be like the most horrifying thing I could have possibly imagined.
Sure would.
So you're right, and the caller is right. So we constantly need to recalibrate how we think about values. And to me, this sort of this illustrates a core point in all of this, which is technology is constantly moving, society is constantly evolving, and we have to figure out how to bring those two together in a more meaningful way. So, you know, AI is rigid at the moment. Artificial narrow intelligence or weak AI is what we're currently working with. And that is essentially just systems that can do very granular tasks or make granular decisions using a bunch of data and do that better, faster, more efficient than we can on our own. The trick is, as we move away from singular decisions to more general interpretations and inferences, somehow, you know, values come into play. And in a much more profound way, which means that the people who created the systems, who selected the data sets, who did the training, who released the systems, which, by the way, as they evolve, will start behaving in unpredictable ways by design. What that effectively means is that their values, much more so than ours, are what pumps through all of these systems.
And is this at the top of their to-do list as they develop these systems that will be unpredictable? It's what they want. You pointed out in the book, these machines being unpredictable is exactly what they want them to do so that they can machine learn and make more and more complex decisions. Are they thinking through these very questions? Are they thinking through, gosh, what happens when this machine makes New York City as efficient as possible and says, you know, the way to do that is get rid of all the tall dudes? Because it's a logical conclusion. Are they thinking through how to prevent the kinds of decisions that will cut against who we want to be as people?
My observation in meeting with lots and lots of engineers and incredibly smart, dedicated people who work at places like Google and Amazon and IBM and Microsoft and Apple is that they want to do this. The problem is that they don't have time or space for it. I mean, the whiteboards in these places are insane. And if you're in a situation where you're trying to prioritize for your next quarterly meeting because you've got to produce the shiny, then something like future risk gets pushed down. And at some point, we see outcry among engineers who don't like the direction that their technology is moving. And again, I think if we had more transparency and, you know, there are so many different ways companies can approach this topic without it cutting into their productivity or bottom line. You know, they can produce and enforce a code of ethics. They can have a series of questions that get to the heart of ethics. They can diversify their staff, not just in gender, you know, and ethnicity and all the rest, but they can also bring on board ethicists and people who understand strategic foresight and philosophers, actual philosophers, not just people who have changed their job titles, to broaden out the worldview and to help add some contour and some context here, but that, you know, this is not a difficult thing to do. But everybody has to agree that is the best way forward, and they shouldn't chastise these companies when they want to make some of these changes.
And in a word, because it's time to go, maybe try to find a way to ease off of them a little bit on delivering the next shiny, the next duplex. Give them some time to think through these things that make such a difference to us all.
Right. These nine companies certainly have their own agenda. The big nine have their own agenda. But we as individuals play a role, too. We have to redefine and I think reclaim the developmental track of AI for our futures and for ourselves. We individuals all play a stake in what's coming. We all have a stake in what's coming, and we can all play a role in what's coming. And we can help to prevent the warping of the future of humanity. We just have to get down to brass tacks and get to work.
I want to give Aaron the very last word on this issue, who writes on our webpage. I don't agree with the idea that Russia isn't a threat, but it's not just about the dissemination of information. It's also about the collection of information. I would be extremely reluctant to have an Alexa thing in my house because we really have no idea what kind of information it's collecting and sending to the company that made it for profit. Amy Webb, I want to thank you for joining me for this fascinating and too brief discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Amy Webb is professor of strategic foresight at NYU, founder of the Future Today Institute, and author of the new book, The Big Nine: How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp humanity. And I want to thank all of you for joining our discussion and making it a piece of human intelligence that we can all be proud of. This show was produced by Denise Couture and Haley Blassingame. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from the humans of WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick, in for Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for being with us. This is 1A.